this isn't my autobiography. This is the story of a challenger tennis player who's able to give you insights into this world that you think you know, but you don't. And I was at that really, really nice vantage point where 128 players play in the main draw of Wimbledon every year. My highest ranking was 129. So I was perched on the edge, literally, between these two worlds of making it and not making it.
Hello and welcome to Outlines, a podcast about sport, stories and the media. My name's Owen Connolly, hope you're well. It is great to have you listening. Athlete memoirs, biographies and autobiographies are the absolute bedrock of sports publishing. A chance to get into the minds of people we've watched from afar, maybe even people whose exploits have in some way shaped our own memories and personal histories. Often a bit of a commercial banker too, let's be fair. Some are good, lots are fine, some are very bad. The best ones, though, can challenge assumptions and tell stories just a bit bigger than themselves. Conor Nyland is one of Ireland's most successful tennis players. He was at one point the 129th best men's singles player in the world. I don't know about you, but I don't imagine I'll be the 129th best at anything anytime soon. But in the world of professional tennis, that's the kind of ranking that comes with perilous downsides, a career of compromises, sacrifices, and precarious globe-trotting grind. That existence on the fringes of the elite is one that Conor details in The Racket, on tour with tennis's Golden Generation and the other 99%. First released in the summer of 2024, it's a rich evocation of life as a pro, from the colourful personalities to the bone-tired mundanities. But it's also about the mindset it takes to be really, really, really good at something, as well as the details that can stop you from reaching the very top. Bad luck, bad timing, and even the small, often sensible and well-meaning human decisions that can take you on a slightly different course. It was a deserved winner of the coveted William Hill Sportsbook of the Year. It's still just about the reigning titleist at the time of recording and went into paperback a few months ago. I've been keen to talk to Conor since launching this podcast, since I was planning it, frankly, and was lucky enough to tear him away from the day job a couple of weeks back. We discussed the inspiration for the book and how it took the shape it did, his collaboration with the journalist Gavin Cooney, our understanding of the athlete voice, what's next for tennis, what's next for him in tennis, and much more besides. Hope you'll find it all as insightful as I did. As ever, if you're enjoying the podcast, then please do spread the word however you can. Rate, review, subscribe, share links. Social media details are in the show notes. Whatever you can do to support is much appreciated. I'm having a great time bringing these conversations to you. And it's a real pleasure to introduce this one. Here is Conor Nyland. So, I mean, the long list was out a couple of weeks ago for the William Hill Sportsbook of the Year. Are you relieved that there's no ranking points to defend with that title?
Very good. Yeah, that year, that 52 weeks on the tennis circuit came around very quickly. So, yes, I am. I don't have to defend, but a little bit sad that, you know, I passed the baton on, I guess, to somebody else. But no, it's amazing to be part of that club, William Hill winner. And yeah, it was a really special day. But can't believe it's a year. It's gone by very fast.
Yeah. Well, you're not, I mean, you still, at the time of recording anyway, you haven't quite had a successor yet. So you're still the reigning holder of that particular title. I mean, that must have been surreal when you went through that whole process. And, you know, and obviously it's, the book was well received and made a lot of headlines, particularly over the summer during the kind of the main European swing of the tennis season. But like that moment when you're on the list to start with, and you know, and you get that call, what do you remember about that?
Yeah, well, they did very well in terms of keeping it a genuine secret. I had no idea. I don't know about the rest of the contestants, but I'm pretty sure nobody in the room outside of obviously the people behind the whole thing knew who was going to be called out as the winner. And there was, in hindsight, maybe little hints and that, but not really. So yeah, it became surreal is the word. It became, I suppose, a possibility when the long list came out. And I guess I said it on stage after I'd been given the prize that my brother had told me, the Christmas before the book had come out, after he'd read it, that he thought I was going to win the William Hill. That's how highly he thought of the book, and I obviously took it with a little bit of a grain of salt, and that he's my brother. He was very invested in the story emotionally, but at the same time, my brother tends to be, he can hit the nail on the head sometimes. So I felt like it was very good, felt like it had a chance, but also knew the chances were going to be slim, that, I would be in with a chance, but the chances were always against me being the one name to get pulled out. And yeah, it was a wonderful moment and a genuine delight. Feel very fortunate that I was able to have that moment and for, again, to stay with the book and hopefully help the book kind of endure, I suppose.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you do have that in your background a little bit. You're a literature grad as well. How long had you wanted to do this, or how long had you thought this was a possibility to tell the story of your career in this way?
Yeah, well, it was a long time in the making from those first words, I guess, I wrote. It was the guts of 4 years. I, as you say, I studied English literature at Berkeley. It was always something I was good at, but I never felt, when I was on the tour, that I was squirreling away notes and observations saying I'm going to make a book about all this madness one day. It wasn't like that. But after I finished on the tour, I had a couple of conversations, and we're talking sort of 10 years ago, with a couple of people who thought I had an interesting story to tell. But those people probably didn't appreciate at the time maybe what I could have brought to the table in terms of my own observations and my writing ability. But I had too much on my plate at the time. I was doing a master's. I had just had our first child, and during COVID, I had a bit more time on my hands and started to write, and wrote a little sort of an article guest piece for a charity I'm involved with, and got a kind of a big reaction, and then just started to write, and one sentence became a page, and a page became 10 pages, and showed it to my wife and a friend of mine, and they said, listen, this is really good, let's go and talk to people. And I actually went back to the original publishers who had spoken to 10 years ago, and things had changed and moved on in terms of personnel for them. They were no longer interested, but sat down with Penguin and we just kind of hit it off right from the start, and they said, this is good, but we need more. So I went off and wrote, I don't know, about 50 pages or 40 pages or whatever it was of an outline. And at that point then, I wanted to do the book justice and didn't want to be a hero. And while still working full time, had to be saddled with writing this entirely myself. So spoke to a couple of people, and this is over the course of about a year and a half of working with Penguin. Spoke to a couple of people about maybe collaborating with me and co-writing it. And from, say, summer 2020 to, I think, end of 2021 or so, I'd just been kind of kept on writing notes and adding things and thinking about it subconsciously even as well. And working with the guys in Penguin, we started to work with Gavin Cooney from the 42.ie, which is a sports website, and we just got on great, and we collaborated on the project from there. So yeah, it was a kind of a long process that we were discovering as we went along.
Yeah, and we'll unpack a couple of bits of that in the next few minutes. But that original conversation that you had, or those original sort of exploratory chats you were having with people about doing a book 10 years ago, was that from the perspective of you as kind of the Irish tennis professional and the outlier as being Ireland's most successful men's tennis player? Or was it what the book became, which was the kind of the touring life of someone just outside that tennis elite and the reality of that?
Yeah, exactly. I think the initial, as you say, the say 10 year ago, conversations were a little bit more focused on this Irish story of a player who, quote unquote, makes it or almost makes it on the onto the biggest stages in tennis. And obviously, as the story developed with Penguin, it became a little bit more that this isn't my autobiography. This is the story of a challenger tennis player who's able to give you insights into this world that you think you know, but you don't. And I was at that really, really nice vantage point at 129 in the world, where 128 players play in the main draw of Wimbledon every year. My highest ranking was 129. So I was perched on the edge, literally, between these two worlds of making it and not making it. So Gabe was able to give this really interesting perspective. And then, as I say, was able to sort of deliver that with having an English degree background. So it was just this nice combination. And I think it sort of, it developed and evolved. And again, when I had my first discussions with the team at Penguin, you know, nobody was signing on the dotted line for quite a while. I think the whole project had to sort of be understood by everybody, and getting it right was really important, that this didn't become the autobiography of Cotton Island. And it was actually was to not make this too personal. But obviously I still had to be the narrative voice, and you still needed to care for me and about me. But it needed to be a little bit wider and broader than that too.
Yeah, because like the personal details, you know, the personal becomes universal, I guess, for a lot of players who would have been in your situation. There's, you know, you nearly take the time at the Bulgaria Academy, and you nearly win this game or that game. You know, you have food poisoning against Djokovic, and you don't quite get the draw at Wimbledon against the kind of, I think you've reflected on this elsewhere. If you'd had the Djokovic game at Wimbledon, you'd have got more profile because of you'd have been a local story in a way that you kind of weren't in New York. And, you know, do you feel like, for players in that sort of band between 100 and 250, there's just loads and loads of players who have that particular, they won't specifically be the same, but they'll all have their sort of sliding doors moments and their paths not taken, or, you know, their imperfect choices that they never would have known would lead where they did.
Yeah, 100%. I think they'll all have versions of my story. And I guess that was maybe something that only came out while I worked on the book, were those sliding doors moments and how clear they were. That I think, again, waiting the nearly decade from finishing on the tour to writing the book, I think really helped to give that perspective and to understand, maybe I should have stayed at the Bulgaria Academy. It would have helped my tennis to play 4 hours a day in the sunshine with some of the best players in the world. But weirdly, at the time, you don't quite see it that clearly. The sliding doors element, as you say, is absolutely part and parcel with the story of everybody in that challenger world. And I don't think this book maybe would have worked quite as well if I had been 400 in the world rather than 129, even though a very similar level of play, really, and a very similar story. But I think having that kind of tantalizingly close, fleeting moments, I think the strongest moments of the book are when you feel like, you know, I'm in the room, but nobody can see me, you know, I'm the fly on the wall for everybody. So I had access, I had enough access to give you the insight without ever having to be totally caught up in the madness of it all, of sort of the big time, the very big time of pro tennis.
Yeah. How much work was there, in kind of excavating that angle to the story, or that kind of tenor to it, and B, in selling it in getting, you know, you said it only works once everybody's on board and they understand what the story is. And that's obviously going to be, whether that's Gavin Cooney when you bring him on board, or whether that's other people involved at Penguin, or whether that's, you know, marketing people, whoever else, you know, it ends up at the end, I think, with quite an effective line out to media and the reader. But that takes a lot of work when it's like the vagaries of tennis are such that 129, if you know, the thing that I'm sure people will have said to you a lot in the time since the book's come out, the 129th best footballer in the world might play for the European champions. But the 129th best tennis player in the world is kind of, you know, doomed to semi-obscurity. And it's getting that context right is quite tricky if you're not kind of steeped in the particularities of tennis. So, you know, how much work did you do to narrow down to that point of focus?
Yeah, it took an awful lot of work. And it felt at times like I was sort of swimming in a sea of different avenues with the book, and what to focus on, what not to focus on, and trying to find, I suppose, a balance between showing you how tough this world is and not sort of being woe is me and look how tough this is and don't you feel sorry for me, and having that bit of humor. And the very first meeting I had with Penguin, we referenced, or I referenced, Only a Game by Eamon Dunphy, which is a great book about him playing for Millwall in the lower divisions of not the top three of English football, and Paul Kimmage, A Rough Ride, which is again about being, you know, one of the lower end cyclists of the Tour de France, and so this was those were obvious comparisons in Irish riders that and critically acclaimed. So from the very very start, that was the kind of world that I was reaching for. They were the books that I liked to read. That was kind of what I wanted and felt like I could deliver. But I kind of said also at that first meeting that there needs to be a humor and a winsomeness about this, that I don't want somebody throwing the book across the room at the end saying, what's the point? Now, maybe some people did that anyway, but I think they probably got a few chuckles and laughs and that along the way. So that was really important. But going back to your original question, it took a lot of thought, a lot of editing, to open out that world. Again, there's sort of a chapter on Davis Cup that is brought in. We wanted it to be accessible to people who have never had any interest in tennis. That was really, really important, that it explains things, but not at a patronizing level. So again, I think that was found. So there was a narrative arc there with me trying to make it right. So chronology is your friend was a phrase that Brendan Barrington, our brilliant editor in Penguin, used quite early on. It's a career, right? It's a life. Yeah. So the storyline was relatively chronological, but what to focus on and when was not easy. How much detail do you go into? And I also was conscious that I didn't want this to be a sea of numbers. I lost 7-6, 6-4, 7-5 in the second round of, you know, the $25,000. You know, all of a sudden, it starts to become pretty grim. So there's sort of, you know, entire months and 6 month passages that are taken care of in a sentence, and then obviously the Wimbledon match, which is 4 hours, gets 20 odd pages. So it just naturally came through with editing and hard graft and revising. You know, it was tough going at times. But obviously, it worked out.
Yeah. And the thing you mentioned, developing that sense of perspective, I think for people who've not read the book, like you say, it's not a screed. It's not, I could have been a contender kind of thing. There's quite a lot of gratitude for the experiences that you had. Is that something that kind of came with distance and a little bit of time to think back on your career as a whole and the things you were able to do and able to achieve and what everything you'd been able to put into it?
Yeah, I mean, I had a very good sense of what I did in tennis, what I didn't do. I wasn't under any illusions about that. Some people have said to me that they felt I was a little bit hard on myself in the book, in certain places, but that was just sort of, you know, what I felt was the reality. I'm proud of, you know, getting to have played Grand Slams and that. I do feel there was probably a bit more in me, but at the same time, I think it could have gone a whole lot worse. And I guess this book has sort of reclaimed a little bit more value from some of my mistakes and some of the things that didn't go quite right. And I was able to obviously, kind of mine that for the book, which is, say, I guess, given a little bit more value to some of those mistakes.
Yeah. You've talked about the team at Penguin and about Gavin Cooney. Now, this is an intriguing thing for any sort of athlete memoir or athlete autobiography, like the relationship with the professional writer who comes in. There will be people who barely write a word. It's all done kind of interviews and shaped afterwards. There'll be people who are quite open that, you know, there's a ghost writer, but they're down as a co-author or a sub-author. You obviously had a slightly different relationship here with Gavin. How did that work? When did you decide you wanted that support, and what support was provided? How did you pair up?
Yeah. So as I was saying, I guess earlier, I had I'd done a lot of it in terms of prep and an outline, an awful lot of scenes, I guess you could say, written to give an atmosphere. And I guess it was getting on, 50 pages or so of notes and writing, which we had about a year and a half's worth of work done. Had sort of flirted with a couple of other writers in terms of coming on board, and for whatever reason they didn't quite stick. And then Penguin suggested I have a chat with Gavin, and we went from there. Gavin obviously had my notes. We hit it off straight away. I think we'd have really similar sort of sense of humor and sensibility and sort of outlook on life almost in a way, which is really nice. I think the fact that Gavin was, I guess, a little bit younger than me, I felt like I was more comfortable with it being a partnership. I think if he had been, I don't know, Paul Kimmage, for example, or somebody who was, I guess, had four or five biographies behind him, I would have maybe been a little bit more like, oh, over to you now. But I think me and Gavin just sort of had this real natural rapport and just started to work together on it. So Gavin would, you know, maybe interview me and write something up and send it to me. And I might spend, you know, a few days, sometimes a few weeks, maybe adding in context, my own thoughts, my own writing. The style of the book is very even in terms of the writing tone, which, again, when Gavin would write something, obviously some parts I would leave alone, but some parts I would rewrite, for want of a better word, or edit to put in my own context, my own information, and my own style. So we'd be back and forth, and then we would, you know, send it off to Penguin, who would obviously then have their own thoughts and come back to us. So it was a real collaboration, and obviously Gavin did a brilliant job. It was a partnership or a co-authorship, I guess, is probably the best way of describing it. So a pretty unusual, I would say, for a sporting memoir, and I think that's why it has that little extra layer of depth and that you maybe don't get in an interview. So I was able to add that in myself. It was a great partnership, and he's a good buddy of mine now, you know. So we're tied to each other for life now, you know, which is cool.
Good stuff. Yeah. In terms of the work you put in your own career into documenting it, like, were you a big note taker? Were you, you know, what was the nature of the stuff that you had to work from? Was it just books of results and coaching notes, or?
Yeah, it wouldn't have been any. Yeah, nothing, not much tennis technical stuff in terms of writing down sessions and that. I had some notes. I kept a sort of a journal for a little while, and like most journals, it fell away pretty quickly. But it gave me a nice. I leaned on that a little bit at times. It gave me a nice sense of where I was and what my mindset was. I think it was a trip to Morocco for a couple of Challenger events, and you know, I'm describing the sitting in the airport gate on the way to the plane and just picking up protein powder and stuff with the day before, and spilling the protein powder in my car and stuff, you know, just silly little details. But I don't think I used them specifically in the book, but it just gave me a nice reminder of the sort of crazy nature of my life. But you know what, a lot of it was just stuck in my head, and again, having that, say, 3-4 years, whatever it was, to work on this meant that, and again, I was very interested in writing a great book here. So I was very, my subconscious was working all the time. I was waking up at 3 a.m. and throwing notes and passing some of the coolest stuff in the book is probably stuff I wrote at 3 a.m. on my phone, you know? So I just remembered it, and I was so engaged emotionally in what was happening. It was very easy to recall things. Now, obviously, for the Wimbledon match and the Djokovic match, we had a video, so I went and watched those back with Gavin, and I basically kind of live commented the whole match, and you know, that was sort of how we worked on those chapters. It was not a lot of note. I went back and looked at all my results of my career, which thankfully is on the website, the ITF website, and again that brought back memories and gave me a way to sort of reassemble my career or assemble my career in my head again and see where I was at, and a ranking timeline and all that stuff. So that was all there, and that definitely helped. It was just a little bit of everything. And obviously conversations with my family and conversation with Gavin brought back memories and sort of like that. And again, I would say lots of memoirs and autobiographies with athletes probably have a kind of a strict timeline on them that, you know, we want this out for next Christmas. This needs to be on the shelves next October, get to work. Whereas I suppose in hindsight, I didn't probably appreciate at the time I had the luxury of having a bit of time. Now, we did have a timeline set, but it was quite far out. I think that was just fortuitous. I knew we wanted to publish it around Wimbledon too, which was my idea.
Yeah.
I think they wanted to have it at Christmas. I said, no, we have tennis's Christmas every June, so that's when it's going to come out. And they were like, yeah, okay, good idea.
Yeah, sharp thinking. Were there any stories that you didn't include, and what was your rationale there?
Yeah, I don't think there were there's anything that sort of jumps out at me that I didn't include. I think that's one of the values of the qualities maybe of the book, is that you feel like pretty much everything I had is sort of carved out there on the page. There isn't a whole lot I left behind. There isn't a whole pile. Some of my friends from Limerick and my college roommates in Berkeley are like, where the hell am I not met? How am I not mentioned in the book? You know, I tried to sort of cover that off in the acknowledgements, because I kind of felt like that might be coming down the tracks. And I said, you know, to all my friends, you know, who aren't mentioned doesn't mean you weren't important to me. But, and again, even my brothers are mentioned a couple of times in the book, but like they're obviously this huge part of my life, but because the book is so tennis focused and needs to be kept pretty tight, it can't be going off on tangent. I think that's where a lot of sports books probably go wrong, is they try and be all things to all people, and they start to talk about their best buddy who they went down the fields, you know, playing football with, and their kids, and it's just not that relevant to the story. So I had to kind of cut a lot of that extra stuff. So lots of buddies not mentioned, which is a shame.
Yeah, but I guess it comes back to like that mission of it, where it became less about the autobiography of you as, you know, Ireland's number one, and it became you as the everyman on the Challenger circuit. Yeah. and some of the characters and experiences that grew up out around that.
Yeah, exactly.
You mentioned Eamon Dunphy and Kimmage's work, but were there any other memoirs that you were influenced by, either, you know, in terms of replicating it or that being like a North Star tonally, or just, I mean, Agassi is the big one in the tennis space. Obviously, it's probably the most.
Yeah, I mean, Agassi was kind of the elephant in the room that I think I kind of felt like I nearly had to address within the book, and did. Talked about reading it in 24 hours because I felt like I had the temerity here to write another tennis book, but from a different perspective. And his is probably the iconic sports book at this stage. I think time has sort of been kind to it, and people are still discovering it and enjoying it. So that was something that I think kind of needed to grasp the nettle there and talk about it, which I'm glad I did. And obviously there's the scene with the glass of water and all that in San Jose, which obviously works really well. Open was definitely an influence. I really enjoyed Shoe Dog. Again, I think that was also ghostwritten by the same ghostwriter as Open, and again had a really nice a level of detail. I think was the thing that jumped out at me, particularly in Shoe Dog, maybe even more than in Agassiz, into some of his forays. I don't know if you've read it, but some of his forays into trying to, you know, get the business off the ground in Japan, and sort of, you know, the director from the company leaving the room, and he's going over looking at the contract and sort of flipping it back, and then jumping back in his seat once the guy comes back in the room, and just felt like I was kind of in the room with him a little bit. So, I really enjoyed Shoe Dog. And then, I mean, there's Wright Thompson is a great American sports writer that I really admire as well. So certainly, I guess, absorbed some of that style. And then there's a book called Name All the Animals, which was a memoir by a lady called Alison Smith, an American writer, that I remember referencing with Brendan Barrington early in the project. She I don't think she's written anything else actually, other than a brilliant article on Ursula K. Le Guin called Her Left Hand, The Darkness. But I love her writing. She wrote about losing her brother. It's a true story. It's a memoir, losing her brother in a car accident when she was in high school. And it's just a devastating kind of meditation on her journey out of that grief. And yeah, a book that, yeah, kind of, I really, it kind of hit me pretty hard, that book, for whatever reason. And I sort of admired it. So that was an influence, I suppose. And Barbarian Days by William Finnegan was another wonderful book. Again, I suppose it's a journey or an arc of a life over quite a long period of time, and you're discovering a new sport that you don't know about. In this case, it's surfing, and a world that you don't quite know about, even though he wasn't a professional surfer. And just the language, the quality of the prose, and again, that was really important to me, that this was going to be slightly elevated in terms of have a little bit more literary merit maybe than your standard sports book. So Barbarian Day is a very special, kind of slightly unquantifiable book in some ways. It's a very unique book. It's hard to describe it. You're reading for 20 sentences about how he's on a particular wave, and you're very much in it with him, and huge detail on that. So yeah, I guess they were, you could cite all those as influences.
Yeah, and a similar challenge, I guess, in bringing people into a world that they've seen but might not understand from the outside.
Kind of misconceptions about, probably, as well, yeah.
Yeah, and a world that you're going into on your own as a kind of solo performer. Just coming back to Agassiz on those terms, like, particularly now your career is done, like, how much do you feel like tennis players have the same experience, and then it's you and your game alone out in the world, and you've got all the things of competition and repetition and all the rest of it that comes with being a professional in any sport, and how much did they occupy different worlds? Because you have these interactions with these players, whether they're kind of tuning up in some of these tournaments that you're in at either end of the year, or, you know, as you say, that kind of semi interaction that you had with Agassiz in a what would you call it? A green room? I'm not sure.
Players lounge. Yeah. Players lounge. Yeah. Green room. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. Players lounge. But like, how do you reflect on that now? And how, you know, I don't know if this is something that's come up in conversation with, I mean, something I wanted to get onto was the sort of reception within tennis of this book, but I don't know if it's something that's come up in conversation with players since you published.
Yeah. I've had messages from a good few tennis players. I don't know if they're the target audience here, even though I think lots of them who've played pro tennis will see so much of themselves in it, whether they were, you know, 20 in the world or 1,000 in the world. I think they'll, and even players who just played at the national level, they'll see so much of it. So I definitely think there's a universality to the experience of being a tennis player that's quite unique, that people will see. I don't know if they're the biggest readers in the world, top 100, top 200 tennis players. Obviously, English is not the first language of probably at least half of them, more than half of them are probably. So I don't know how much it's infiltrated that sort of that group of players, men and women. I've had messages from retired ex-Challenger guys, and he just said, you know, they enjoyed it so much and felt, you know, so much connection with it, which is great. But again, they're Americans and British players and that. So, you know, the book hopefully is going to be translated into a couple of languages in the near future, and hopefully that will open it up. Some members of the Irish Davis Cup team have read it and obviously really enjoyed it and saw a lot of their journey too. I think with the Agassiz and the Djokovic is, I guess, what you might call the private jet sort of world almost of pro tennis, where it gets beyond even being a regular famous sports person. You become something of a global, when you're big time in tennis, you're really, 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 really big. Mm. And the wealth and all that goes with it becomes sort of at another level. So, you know, as you can see from Agassi's book, there's so many challenges, and no matter how successful you are, you're still on planet Earth, you know, and a human being. So there's challenges that go with that. So yeah. I'd like to think that he would enjoy it. I believe Jim Courier read it and really, really enjoyed it. Obviously a former world number one, and Tim Henman. So that's really lovely to hear. So I think, and again, American, British. So I think just again with that sort of language thing, there's probably a few guys out there who haven't read it just off the basis of that. But yeah, been lovely to hear that they've taken a lot from it too.
Yeah. Did you? I'm suddenly reminded of. Did you ever read David Foster Wallace on Federer, that essay?
Yeah. And Michael Joyce as well, which was brilliant. I don't know if you.
But I'm reminded of something else that that he wrote, because he played tennis at a kind of youth level, and I remember reading an essay he wrote about sports biographies, and he said, you know, he became a voracious reader of them, but found it like quite an empty experience, because quite often he was looking for something that wasn't there. Like, he had imprinted upon these personalities or projected upon people a depth of feeling around whether it was their sense of purpose or their, you know, and a lot of them just don't think, they think in much more, much more channeled ways about their game and about the opportunities that are ahead of them and how they have to approach them. They're not kind of reflective in the same way, obviously not reflective in the same way as David Foster Wallace would be, but you know what I mean?
I do.
Is that something you're conscious of kind of working in this sort of memoir space that, like,
yeah, a lot of people have said to me, you know, there's probably a little bit too much going on in your head for you to be, you know, able to close out a match at Wimbledon. I think, yeah, the simpler the thought process, the better. But I think if you listen to, you know, an Andre Agassi speak, or say a Jim Courier, they're highly articulate. Mm. I, you know, Novak Djokovic speaks beautiful English and a number of different languages. So Rafa Nadal is like a Buddhist philosopher sometimes with some of the stuff he can come out with. So I don't think there's any lack of sophistication or depth with these guys at all. But I just think it's the choices that they make at a young age, an athletic ability. And I do think you need a kind of an intelligence and a level of perception to be one of the world's great tennis players.
Yeah.
So I don't sort of subscribe to maybe the easy, you know, there's nothing going on in their head, they can just whack balls and that makes life easier.
No, but it's like mastering the direction of thought, I guess, and focusing and shutting out noise and all the rest of it.
Yeah, exactly. And I think I probably stayed my one foot in academics, you know, with finishing school and university and all that for probably a little bit too long as well. And obviously your Andy Murray's and Nadal's and these guys all quit school at 16, again, because their results were so amazing at that age. And that allowed them then to channel all that they have into this one thing. Whereas I was a little bit, my attention was a bit more dissipated probably as well. Not the reason I didn't, not trying to use these as excuses at all, but you know what I mean? It's, it's sort of, it wasn't channeled as early as it could have been.
Yeah. Something that gets talked a lot about today you know, and I'm partly working from my background as an industry journalist here, but is the way that athletes can kind of profile themselves, and whether that's social media, I'm thinking especially of TikTok now, and that ability to build a brand and also an identity and everything else around yourself outside the game and tell your own story, you know, in a constructed way without needing all the kind of other media apparatus that you would have needed even, you know, in the early part of your career. I mean, if you had been playing in this particular environment, would that kind of stuff have been appealing to you? Would it have been appealing to you to start, you know, to create that window into the world of challenger tennis while you were playing? Or is that something that, was that an instinct that kind of came later as your career was winding down and you were trying to, you know, make sense of the whole journey you'd been on?
I mean, I do Instagram sort of badly, you know, like a standard dad that these days. I definitely have missed that boat. I did quite enjoy, Twitter was probably at its height really when I was sort of at my height, I suppose, 2010, 2011. And again, my tweets were a little bit melancholic and introspective and kind of in keeping maybe with sort of the qualities of the book. And so I don't think I would have been a natural TikToker and an Instagrammer. No, I don't think that's kind of my skill set. I think a book was kind of the perfect medium for me to kind of tell my story. And I think there's probably people out there who are much more suited to the Instagram, TikToker world. But I, you know, I'm on social media, and again, I do find it really interesting following the players and they're able to give you an insight into the world. I guess for me, the beauty of a book, the book, is you have this ability to live inside somebody's head for a prolonged period of time and really understand, again, at a level that you just don't get even with, say, a podcast or a social media post. It's just that I think it's a little bit more authentic, and obviously it's a longer period of time you're spending with the person. You know, it takes about 2-3 weeks maybe to read a book, and you just get a slightly different take on it. So I think a book was the right way for me to do it. I don't think I would have been, a TikTok, Instagram superstar in my time, but I probably would have done it and had a go.
Where do you think the conversation goes next about this tier of tennis and this world below the slams and below the, well, I mean, at the foot of the slams, but below that top level of ATP Tour and WTA Tour events and all the rest of it?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's hard to ignore the conversations around just keep coming. It's not going away. It hasn't gone away. I do think prize money has improved, say, at the qualifying level of Grand Slams. The Masters series is now are open to bigger draws, so there's more opportunities for players to earn money. So there's definitely steps being taken, but at the same time, it's still, if you look at a pass fail, is a guy ranked 150, 200 in the world right now getting paid kind of adequately, comfortably? Is he making a living? No, he's not. So that's sort of a fail in my view. So whereas you've got all these members of staff at all these massive organizations and national federations and international tennis federations around the world who are making money, and then the guy ranked 150 in the world or 200 in the world or lady who's at that level is not making that. So I think that's disappointing, but yeah, it seems like it's starting to get a little slowly but surely it's starting to improve, but it's hard to know whether it's going to meaningfully improve enough for it to be kind of where I would like it to be, which, as I say, is that there's 300 players in the world, men, 300 women, who are all making, you know, pretty nice money off being a pro tennis player.
Yeah. What's next for you in tennis? You're still Ireland's Davis Cup captain, but do you see a broader role for yourself? And has the experience of this book changed that perspective at all?
Listen, it's gotten me involved in more conversations around tennis. Don't know if it'll change my role day to day in terms of what I do, but it certainly, I guess, given me a little bit more of a platform to talk about tennis, which is great. And as I say, I still have exactly the same set of jobs that I did when the book came out, which is I work in commercial real estate. I'm with the same company. I'm still Davis Cup captain. And so, yeah, nothing has really changed materially for me, which is fine by me. So I love being part of tennis. I always want to be a part of tennis in some way. I'm Davis Cup captain at the moment. I obviously can't hold on to that role forever, but I'd like to. So, you know, if the Davis Cup role ever did end, and I don't have any plans to at the moment, but if it ever did end, I'd love to replace that with something else. Like, that takes up a little bit of my time every year, but I'd love it. So, I don't rule out being back involved in tennis and pro tennis in some way down the line, but I genuinely don't have something lined up for that. But that would be nice, because it's a huge part of my life, and I know a lot about it. So it'd be a shame not to sort of use that information in some way.
Yeah. At the same time, is it nice having a day job as well?
Yes. It is really nice to to close the laptop at 5:30 or whatever time it is, and be able to sort of walk away from it. And I was talking to somebody recently just about the pro tour, and when I always had my training weeks, you know, you'd be training with a group of players and a coach at a venue, and then on the Saturday morning you would leave that team and go off to a new venue and try and get ready to play, and it would be a 6 a.m. Ryanair flight, and it was just always a challenge. Whereas you have your home comforts now, and you're with the same team, and you don't have to fend for yourself. It's a lot more comfortable. So that's nice.
Yeah. Okay. Quickly before we go, there's three questions that we ask every guest on the podcast. I think I know this one, having read the book, but do you have an origin story or something that sparked your interest in sport?
Well, yeah, I mean, yeah, it was, I was the youngest of four kids who all played, and my sister Gina was, we lived across the road from a tennis club in Birmingham in England, and my sister and brother got really, really good, at 8, 9, 10, and I came along, and there was a racket in my hand at 18 months, and then we moved back to Ireland, and we had a tennis court at home, and it was just what we did. So, there was no first day at the courts for me. It was just always a part of my life.
Yeah, no getting out of it. what's your favorite piece of sports storytelling?
Well, I mentioned earlier, Wright Thompson, the American journalist, who's got a couple of great pieces. Actually, there's a brilliant piece by another American sports writer, Brian Phillips, who writes for The Ringer, and he wrote a brilliant book. Or sorry, a brilliant long article about visiting Wimbledon. I think it's called "The Death's Head of Wimbledon," and it's just the tone of it's really funny. It's really unexpected. He's just a great writer. But yeah, Wright Thompson has a devastating article about Dan Gables, who was an American wrestling coach, and it's a long form article that he wrote. It starts out talking about Dan Gables later in life and how wrestling was not going to be part of the Olympics. He was a wrestling coach at a college in the US, and how disappointed he was. And then it goes back on his family and family tragedy that just rocked me, to be honest. It was a really tough read, but in Roy Thompson's hands, it was handled so well. So he's a really outstanding sports writer.
Yeah. And what's a sports story that you like to tell, if that's something that's still in your future or that you'd like to see somebody else tell?
That's the main one is done, that's for sure. I don't know. I don't have any major plans. I love track and field. I love athletics. If there's a big athletics championships on, I always tune in and really enjoy it. Again, it's so elemental and it's so international as well. I guess I'm attracted to that, and we've some really good athletes at the moment as well in Ireland. I really enjoy that. I mean, that would maybe be one if I was going to switch codes, maybe. But yeah, I don't know. I don't have any plans to or any hankering to write one specifically, but maybe that would be one to do if it wasn't tennis.
Yeah. Is there anything in tennis that's been overlooked, a story or a career that you think hasn't had the discussion that maybe it deserves?
I'm not sure. There's been lots of not only books but movies as well, right, with the Williams sisters and King Richard and the Bobby Riggs, Billie Jean King was made into a movie as well, which was really quite good, actually. There was a John McEnroe biopic. So it feels like there's actually quite a bit in the media regarding tennis. So no, there's nothing that sort of jumps out at me. I think this was maybe the story in tennis that hadn't been told. I would love to read a tell all from somebody who had maybe been on the board of I don't know, one of the big ITF or ATP organizations and all that goes on in relation to the wrangling around calendars and who gets what and where and players' demands and all that. Obviously, you get snippets of that world from my book, but maybe it doesn't have all the details. So it would be cool, but I'm sure a brave man to write that one.
Okay, well, your entry is much appreciated, and so is your time. I've really really enjoyed it, and thanks again.
Thank you. Cheers, Owen. Thanks very much. Cheers.
Outlines is an original production from 2640.